It's Wednesday, December 18, 2013. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. Christians are finished here. That very sad statement was made by a Christian in the nation of Iraq, and it requires a close investigation. The Telegraph, the BBC, and other British media have been giving incredible attention to the evacuation of the Middle East of its Christian population. To their credit, many American media sources have also been giving very serious attention to this phenomenon. We're talking about the literal evacuation of the Middle East of its Christian population. As the Telegraph reports, just looking at the nation of Iraq, where there had once been more than a million Christians during the time of Saddam Hussein, there are now only about 200,000, and many, if not most of them, have signaled that they're trying to leave. The reason for that is traceable directly and generally to the American military involvement in Iraq. The fall of the regime of Saddam Hussein meant that the protector of the Christian and other minority populations in that country had been removed. Saddam Hussein was a vicious dictator. One of the ways he controlled his country was by maintaining an artificial form of a religious peace. When he was no longer present, there was no longer the artificial force for that peace, and the dominant Muslim populations began to eradicate areas, regions, villages, and towns of their entire Christian population. Colin Freeman of the Telegraph, reporting from Baghdad, spoke of one town there in Iraq, a town called Dura. It was once one of the biggest Christian communities in Iraq. One local Christian authority there said it at one point had 30,000 Christian families within the town. Now, only 2,000 are left. Quote, they feel they are strangers in their own land, and that makes them want to leave. The bleeding from migration is continuous, end quote. Churches throughout the Middle East, but particularly in places such as Iraq and Egypt, have been defaced. They've been destroyed. Some churches have been burned. In Egypt, the Coptic Christian community is being depopulated by this kind of oppression and persecution, and the same thing is taking place in Iraq and elsewhere. But right now, ground zero for this kind of phenomenon is the nation of Syria, a nation that for the last 2 years has been experiencing a bitter and bloody civil war. And the same phenomenon that took place in Iraq is taking place there. In Iraq, the dictator was Saddam Hussein. In Syria, the dictator has been Bashar Assad, and before him, his father, Hafez Assad. Both of them had restrained the religious majority, the Muslim majority, in order to keep an artificial peace. But now that the civil war is taking place, very historic Christian towns and villages are being evacuated of Christians. Now, let's remember, when we're talking about Syria, we're talking about the nation that includes the city of Damascus. That is the very same Damascus toward which the Apostle Paul was headed when he had his face-to-face encounter with the Lord Jesus Christ and received his apostolic call. So it's that nation and so many of the historic Christian villages and towns in Syria that are now being depopulated of the Christian community. The persecution of Christians worldwide is part of the larger phenomenon that we have seen, and especially when you're facing an overwhelming Islamic population majority, it is becoming very, very difficult, tenuous to say the least, and dangerous in many cases, for Christians to live in these increasingly Islamicized nations. Interestingly, just a matter of a few weeks ago, Pope Francis said that the entire church was in peril in the region, and then he made this statement, quote, we will not resign ourselves to imagining a Middle East without Christians, end quote. Well, the Pope may not be resigning himself to that, but the Christians in the region clearly are. One of the Christians cited in the article in the Telegraph, a man who has lost a brother and a son to anti-Christian terrorism, said this, I will leave whenever I can. Christians are finished here in Iraq. This should be of direct concern, of course, to every believing Christian everywhere in the world. Wherever Christ Church is suffering this kind of persecution, it should, of course, rally the prayer and the concern of all Christians everywhere, not just for the protection and honoring of our Christian brothers and sisters, but also for the furtherance of the gospel. Because where there are no Christians, there is no Christian witness. And let's face it, that is the real issue for many in terms of the persecution of Christians. They not only want there to be an absence of Christians in the territory, they want to make certain there is no Christian symbolism, there is no Christian representation, and there is no Christian witness. Thus, all Great Commission Christians must be very concerned about this kind of a headline, and of course, far beyond that, the individuals who are represented behind this story. We must recognize that the Great Commission has always called Christians to leave safety and comfort for discomfort and a lack of safety, oftentimes even explicit danger. We fool ourselves if we think that was true only in the first century. It's true now. Just ask this man in the Middle East, who said with such a tragic voice, Christians are finished here. Shifting the scene to Great Britain, we need to recognize once again that oftentimes the collision between religious faith and the courts leads to a very bad, if not bizarre, result. In Great Britain, a recent decision tends to lean more towards the bizarre and revealing than anything else. The scene is Britain's highest court, and in a landmark judgment, as is reported by The Telegraph, five of the highest justices of the highest court in Britain have now redefined religion in order to allow the Church of Scientology to officiate at weddings. A very strange reason, perhaps, but an even more strange form of argument that you find within the justices' decision. It follows a five-year legal battle, says The Telegraph, by Louisa Hodkin, who is a 25-year-old Scientologist seeking to get married in the Church of Scientology Chapel in central London. This had been a problem for the last several years because the British government doesn't recognize the Church of Scientology as a church. Why does it not? Well, it's because back in 1855, Parliament there established a law known as the Places of Worship Registration Act, which defines religion and those identifiable and recognized religious organizations such as churches as those that include the reference to a deity, and only theistic faiths were ruled, according to this legislation, to be true religions. In other words, the Church of Scientology, which uses the word God but has no theistic reference attached to it, was ruled not to be a church, and therefore not to be able to conduct legal weddings. But the Supreme Court of Great Britain has now reversed that, and according to that court, you no longer have to have any kind of belief in God to function as a religion. I told you this was interesting. The actual logic of the decision gets even more interesting. Lloyd Neuberger, the president of the Supreme Court, joined by four other justices, ruled that the discrimination against the Church of Scientology amounted to a false discrimination that excluded groups that do not formally worship a god or gods. The court, according to The Telegraph, heard that although Scientologists use the word God in services, the term is understood to mean infinity, no specific being. Then Lord Tolson, one of the justices, said this, and I quote, "Unless there is some compelling contextual reason for holding otherwise, religion should not be confined to religions which recognize a supreme deity," end quote. Well, what in the world then would religion mean? Lord Tolson wasn't finished. He declared this, "First and foremost, to do so would be a form of religious discrimination unacceptable in today's society," end quote. So you have one of the justices of the highest court in Great Britain saying that it's too much to expect a religion to be religious. So how then are they going to define religion? Well, evidently, they put themselves religiously at work trying to find a non-religious definition of religion. As The Telegraph reports, the justice concluded that religion could be defined more accurately as, quote, "a spiritual or non-secular belief system which claims to explain mankind's place in the universe and relationship with the infinite and give people guidance on life." That's how The Telegraph included and described the justice's argument. So in other words, right now, according to the Supreme Court in Great Britain, a religion there doesn't have to include anything that has to do with any kind of God, singular, plural, whatsoever. All it has to do is be spiritual or non-secular. But wait just a minute. What would non-secular mean if you eradicate belief in God from the definition? Well, non-secular means it's not secular. In other words, they have no idea what it means. Just to make that clear, the justice went on, quote, "Such a belief system may or may not involve belief in a supreme being, but it's going to involve something. What is that?" This is what he said. "It does involve a belief that there is more to be understood about man's nature and relationship to the universe than can be gained from the senses or from science," end quote. Seriously? All it means to be religious is to believe that somehow our own senses and modern science can't give us everything that is required for us to understand everything about humanity and our place in the universe? You know, looking at this particular report, something strikes me immediately. It's becoming harder and harder to be a heretic these days because the standard of theological deviancy has been lowered so much in many denominations, they've already denied or allowed the denial of every major Christian doctrine that it's virtually impossible to be a heretic. Well, now in Great Britain, according to this definition, it's hard to be secular because the only way you can be secular, evidently, is by declaring, "I'm secular." If you're not secular, then you're religious, and all you have to do to be religious is not be secular. If this makes sense to you theologically, you're in big trouble. Go look at the Bible. If this makes sense to you in legal terms, evidently you belong in the highest court of Great Britain. Shifting the scene now to Korea, the beleaguered nation of North Korea, the issue is, now you see him, now you don't. The man who's not now seen is Jang Song-taek, the uncle and the former mentor of the current dictator of North Korea, Kim Jong-un. Now, Kim Jong-un has been in power for only about 2 years, and when he came to power, his uncle was his protector and the one who was, as the elder statesman, supposedly to give guidance to the young new leader, who was then not even age 30. But now, Jang Song-taek has been frog-marched out of a meeting of the party and summarily executed after having to admit crimes against the regime, including his admission of trying to launch a coup against the leader. But as you look at these particular charges, the charges to which this uncle, very sad and tragically related uncle of this Korean dictator, confessed, what you're looking at here is that most of this takes us right back to something that those who lived through the 20th century should see and recognize all too tragically as familiar, and that is the era of Joseph Stalin in the Soviet Union. The situation with Joseph Stalin was such that if you were on the inside and you were his friend and he was for you, you were safe, but he could turn on you in an instant. In the period after the Second World War, a series of show trials eradicated virtually all of the generals who had won in the great effort called the Great Patriotic War that we call World War II. As a matter of fact, almost no one who was with Stalin in the beginning survived him even for a few years. He would not allow anyone to be popular alongside him, and even the slightest personal insult led to your immediate disappearance. It's often tempting for Americans to think that we can discuss issues of political structure and political systems in a very remote and merely academic way. But if you're living in a nation such as North Korea, this is not an academic exercise. It is a daily matter of horrifying life and death. One of the crimes this man confessed to, even as he was facing his sure and certain summary execution, was, quote, behaving so arrogantly and insolently as unwillingly standing up from his seat and half-heartedly clapping, end quote, during a Workers' Party of Korea meeting described by Time magazine as ecstatic. Rookie error, declared Michael Crowley of Time magazine. He went on to say, applause enthusiasm is a critical and time-honored means of survival in a dictatorship. And at that point, he takes us to one of the most unimpeachable and authoritative witnesses of the 20th century, none other than Alexander Solzhenitsyn, that great voice for freedom who won the Nobel Prize, even as he became one of the most famous political prisoners in the world before he immigrated to the United States. In his famous account of the Soviet age, and especially the age of Stalin, the book was entitled The Gulag Archipelago, he describes a tribute to Comrade Stalin, for which, as Time says, the audience leaps to its feet, roaring with applause. Solzhenitsyn then wrote this, for 3 minutes, 4 minutes, 5 minutes, the stormy applause rising to an ovation continued, but palms were getting sore, and raised arms were already aching, and the older people were panting from exhaustion. It was becoming insufferably silly even to those who really adored Stalin. However, who would dare to be the first to stop? The secretary of the district party committee could have done it. He was standing on the platform, and it was he who had called for the ovation. But he was a newcomer. He had taken the place of a man who had been arrested. He was afraid. After all, the secret policemen were standing in the hall applauding and watching to see who quit applauding first. Solzhenitsyn describes the scene as the applause for Stalin went on for 8, 9, 10 minutes. Finally, at the 11th minute, the director of the local paper factory stopped clapping and sat back down. Solzhenitsyn then wrote, that same night, the factory director was arrested. Solzhenitsyn then wrote this. They easily pasted 10 years on him on the pretext of something quite different. But after he had signed the Form 206, the final document of the interrogation, his interrogator reminded him, don't ever be the first to stop applauding. Every single system of government is based upon worldview presuppositions, convictions about the nature of humanity and the dignity of human life. What you find in the kind of dictatorship that was represented by Joseph Stalin and now by Kim Jong-un in North Korea is a regime that is based upon the understanding that the only human life worth living is the life of the dictator. Everyone else lives by his pleasure and, of course, dies by his displeasure, going right down to his uncle, who was the very one who assured him of gaining the place in power and of gaining ascendancy just 2 years ago. Against those who had even recently claimed that the march of history was moving everywhere simultaneously toward democracy, the Wall Street Journal's editorial board responded by pointing to this event and the reality therapy that follows. They then wrote this, it turns out that there is a challenge to democratic capitalism, the eternal human temptation to rule and subjugate other human beings. The motivating ideology varies, such as fanatical Islam, what is left of communist belief in China and North Korea, tribalism in parts of Asia and Africa, or simply the quest for power and control. The deep evil at the heart of this North Korean regime has been there for all to see for the better part of a half century and more. Even recently, we discussed the fact that people were publicly executed in North Korea for crimes such as watching a Western television program or owning and possessing a Bible. The Wall Street Journal says, however, this is not a danger limited to North Korea. As the editorial board declared, that mind, speaking of the evil totalitarian mind of North Korea, is increasingly a threat to all of us because it is quickly gaining the technology to kill people far beyond Pyongyang. North Korea already has nuclear warheads, and before too long, it will have a missile that can reach U.S. shores. End quote. A sobering reflection for us all. Shifting back for a moment to Great Britain, finally we look at the fact that the issue of assisted suicide is now reaching that same high court that just recently ruled on the issue of defining religion. And this is what makes the issue particularly interesting. The lawyers who've gone to the court arguing for assisted suicide made the plea before the justices this week that the issue of morality should be excluded from the court's deliberations. In other words, they said, this is a matter of individual rights, not a matter of right and wrong. To their credit, the justices did not appear to be buying this argument. As a matter of fact, they recognize the fact that there is no clear distinction between issues of right and wrong. One of the arguments being made, by the way, by the proponents of assisted suicide is that euthanasia for animals puts them in a better position than those who are very ill as human beings. In other words, it's unfair. But that also betrays the kind of thinking that goes behind the assisted suicide movement. We're not animals, and human life is not the equivalent of animal life. And when you look at an issue like this, you recognize how tempting it is for people to try to think, not just on this issue, but on any number of issues, that we can exchange the language of right and wrong, the language of morality, for merely the language of liberation, the language of political rights. Mary Ann Glendon of the Harvard Law School years ago wrote a book entitled Rights Talk, in which she said that this is exactly what so many amongst the cultural elites in the United States and European nations are trying to do. Get rid of the conversation about right and wrong. Try to leave that behind as part of a civilization, the dark ages we've left behind, and just deal with the issues of individual rights. But as Mary Ann Glendon made very clear, writing with a legal analysis, not a theological analysis, it's impossible to talk about the grounding of human rights without talking about morality, because human beings are moral creatures, and rights are themselves moral entities. Making the plea for assisted suicide, one attorney said there before Britain's High Court, quote, the question is not one of right or wrong. It is a question of weighing relative risks that can be objectively ascertained from evidence. That is a question that the court is as well, if not better, placed to answer as Parliament, end quote. Well, in other words, you could turn that around and say neither the court nor the British Parliament can deal with this issue without dealing with morality. It is a question of right or wrong, which in this case is also a question of life or death. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmoeller.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Moeller. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.